condensed matter core course. So I thought I would take an opportunity to tell you about some numerical approaches that you can use to study condensed matter systems, or in particular, I guess this is going to be a good fit with also some classical statistical mechanics. So specifically, I'm going to talk about a method that I've used a lot, which is Monte Carlo methods. And we'll specifically look at the example of the XY model, although a lot of what I'll talk about is not so specific to XY. You could use it for a lot of other models as well. So I'll try to make it clear when I'm doing something that's specific for XY. All the first parts of what we'll talk about is actually quite general. I've put the main reference here. Just to remind you, this is not going to be on your interview. So this is just something to kind of add on to the course. And as we'll talk about, and as you might remember, the XY model has some similar features to some of these BCS superconductors that we studied in the course. So it is kind of relevant to do these kinds of simulations to numerically study some phenomena that we saw in the course. So some people already noticed I wrote the link for the anonymous questions here. So I won't be able to check this all the time like I was able to when I was watching, but I want to see how well I can do it at checking it once in a while. We've never done it where the actual lecturer is checking. So let's see. I can't promise that I'm going to always remember to check. You can remind me, although I guess then it's not anonymous if you have to remind me to check. So yeah, I'm going to do my best, but like we'll have this be a bit of an experiment to see how well that goes. So. Okay. Any questions about the plan or anything? So in the outline, you can just see some words that I hope you're going to be familiar with by the end of the lecture. On the left here, I've written kind of a goal, which is a fairly broad goal in statistical mechanics, or maybe also in many, many fields of condensed matter, which is that we want to study interesting phenomena, maybe like phase transitions. But in general, in systems where we have n particles that are interacting and n is large, this can be very difficult. So I want to kind of look at the numerical side of tackling this problem. So let's look at the case of a classical system. And let's just consider some general observable that we might want to calculate. So if we think about the canonical ensemble where we have our system in equilibrium with some kind of a heat bath that's at a fixed temperature, I could look at the expectation value of just some quantity Q, and this is just going to be some weighted average over all possible values that I could find if I sum over all configurations. So when I write this, my probability in statistical mechanics in these systems is going to just be this Boltzmann distribution, and Z is just my partition function. So actually, I should also mention, I mean, we're interested in kind of this maybe statistical mechanics setting where we're going to look at phase transitions as a function of temperature, but even some of these methods would be more general. This P mu doesn't have to be in this form. It can just be some probability distribution that you wish to study. But this is the one we're going to look at. And then just some notation, just to remind you. I'm always going to set the Boltzmann constant equal to 1 in things that we do, so just remember that. When I sum over mu, what do I really mean? I'm summing over microstates of the system. And then E mu is the energy. So definitely I haven't said anything specific to XY model yet. Depending on what system I'm studying, it's going to put constraints on the type of states that I can have and also on the way that I calculate my energy for a given state. Okay, and really what a very broad goal when we're studying phase transitions is that we want to, in order to do that, we often want to look at many different expectation values in the limit where I have a very large number of particles. So let's see, any questions so far? No? Okay. Anyone else have any questions? Oh yeah.
How does this quantity depend on n, the number of particles?
Well, I guess first of all, you're gonna see, I think, very shortly, but many things here do. So for example, like the number of items that you have to sum over is gonna depend on n, right? The way that we calculate our energy is gonna, again, it also involve usually like summing over all degrees of freedom in our system. So yeah, but I'll make it more explicit right now. So let's look at an example. Let's look at the icing model as an example. So we'll talk more about the XY model in a bit, but I think most people would agree the icing model is more simple than the XY model. So doing this task for an icing model should be even easier than doing it for the XY model. And I want to show you that it's very hard already if I don't use sophisticated techniques if I wanted to actually directly evaluate this sum. So just to remind you, for an icing model, just so you become familiar with my notation, I have some spins on a lattice. Here I'm drawing just a square lattice. And here this is two-dimensional in my drawing. And maybe this is I'm going to label my sites by some index I. Here, I calculate my Hamiltonian by just some simple sum, which I think you guys saw in your statistical mechanics course. And my degrees of freedom are just plus or minus one. My number of particles in this case is just L to the D, so I drew it in two dimensions, but it can be any dimension. I should also note that we have exact known solutions that don't rely on numerical methods in dimensions one and two. So although there's still, you can find still a lot of papers that examine icing, numerical features of the icing model in two dimensions, just because it's a good test case for a lot of new methods that people develop. So just to emphasize though, the numerical methods are maybe not critical until we get to higher dimensions. For more complicated models though, we don't have analytical solutions even in those lower dimensions. So, but let's still, I mean, even though we have an exact solution, we can still talk about how we would approach this numerically. So let's imagine that if I don't want to make use of any nice theoretical techniques that you might have done in your in either the statistical mechanics front end or the core course, imagine I just want to do this sum directly by actually summing over all of those terms. How many terms would I have to sum over? Can somebody have an answer for how many states I would have to sum over in this case? What's my number of accessible states? Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So it's 2 to the n, oops, sorry, which is 2 to the power of l to the d, right? So in two dimensions, you're right, it's l squared, but we can also look at this in general dimensions. Okay, so this scales exponentially. Exponential scaling is, in general, very bad, but let's just kind of see like how bad it is in this program, in this problem, sorry. Okay, so this was actually a winter school project a few years back. Students were trying to develop the fastest methods that they could to evaluate sums like this numerically. And so I asked them what the fastest algorithms they were able to find were, and they told me that if you had about 25 spins, they were able to do these sums in about a minute on a typical computer. Of course, if I had a better computer, it might be a little bit better, but this is not going to change by more than maybe a factor of 10, depending on what device I'm using, let's say. Okay, so let's now consider how this is going to scale. If I look at different values of n, so I just told you if I have n is 25, just 25 spins, this requires about a minute. Well, this means that if I increase this by 10, since this scales exponentially, already doing this sum is going to take about 20 hours. So, okay, it's a long time. We could still do it, right? If I go up to 50 spins, this is actually going to take 60 years to do this sum directly. But let's think, 60 years, yeah, it's a lot. I'm not going to run that on my laptop, obviously. But we have a lot of sophisticated computers available to us. We could actually split this sum maybe onto many different nodes of a supercomputer. We could actually probably do this, right? We wouldn't actually take 60 years in physical time. We would spread that 60 years out. So we could actually do 50. But let's say now we go up to, say, 80. I mean, of course, you can look at many numbers in between, but if I go up to 80, doing this sum is going to require longer than the age of the universe to do this sum. So, you know, no matter how we split this up, even if I get a slightly faster computer, it's basically hopeless to do this directly. So let's go back. Now, I mean, right now I've just been talking about these sums as a function of n. I haven't really talked about what dimension I'm in, but So if I basically were limited to something on the order of about 50 spins. So for the icing model in 2D, that just means maybe a 7x7 or an 8x8 lattice is roughly what we could do. Okay, and I mean for XY this would be much worse. In this case I don't have just two accessible states per site, I have a continuous number, so of course this is going to be much, much worse in that case. So we need some more sophisticated numerical methods than just, you know, directly evaluating a sum on a computer. Anybody have questions so far?
Yes.
Yeah?
Why do you count the difficulty in terms of number of spins and a number of links?
I'm just, I mean, the motivation is...
Because at the end...
No, it's, I'm not counting it in terms, I mean, here I'm just tallying this in terms of number of spins. I mean, the number of links would be some linear factor of that. But the time actually scales as like 2 to the n. Like this goes as 2 to the n, right? Because the number of states that I have to sum over goes as 2 to the n.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So,
does it make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I just used this to kind of index the table. That's it, yeah. It doesn't scale linearly.
Yeah, the difficult sum is not the sum in the Hamiltonian, it's the sum over...
No, right. Yeah. Yeah, and I should also mention that too, actually, that right now I'm kind of assuming an easy sum to evaluate, like in the Hamiltonian, that this sum scales in a specific way. I mean, there can also be cases where those observables are more difficult to calculate, but... Okay, so far I haven't actually talked about classical Monte Carlo, so let's actually talk about how these methods address this difficulty and what they are. So, what the main idea is in Monte Carlo is that I still want to, in some way, evaluate these sums in some kind of an approximation, but rather than including all of this exponential number of states, I'd like to be able to consider only m states that are somehow selected at random. There's many different ways to select them at random, as we'll see. But we're going to see how we could estimate those quantities if we only consider some subset of states. I should mention here. Of course, we ideally want to have m much, much smaller than n so that we avoid this exponential complexity. Okay, so the most naive thing I could do, which I think you could still consider a Monte Carlo method, is that I could just imagine I have all of these 2 to the n states and I could just choose m of them completely at random. Well, then the expression for this expectation value or at least the estimate that I would get for it would be quite simple. I would basically just replace what I'm summing over. Okay, so I'm no longer summing over n, 2 to the n terms, I'm just summing over m of them, and I'm just gonna look at what I get from there. Okay, so does anybody have any guesses for how, or any intuition for how well this would work? Do you think there's, can you think of a case where it would work well, a case where it wouldn't work well? Okay, let me give you a hint. So let's think about, can you guys read if I still write here? Is this okay? Yeah? I won't go over there, but this is okay, right? Okay. So what if I think about high temperature? What do I expect to find? What is some feature I expect in, say, an icing model at high temperature? Disordered states, right? So what does that mean if I say they're disordered? There's lots of entropy, right? There's probably lots of states that are contributing to my sum. My Boltzmann distribution becomes quite flat, right, in this limit. Lots of states are contributing to my sum. So actually, this works very well at high temperature. And you can actually show that we're going to develop better algorithms, but at high temperature, it essentially reduces to doing this, just choosing a state at random and summing over them. But often we're interested in order we can get in our systems at low temperature, and this doesn't work well at low temperature.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So the idea at high T is just that there'll be a bunch of different states that are contributing, so that it's fine to like kind of sample through a bunch of them.
Yeah, and if you were to look, you would find, if you were to look at the distribution of, say, your energy or some other observable over all possible states, you wouldn't find like a sharp peak in only one region of your state space. Okay. You would find that by sampling all of them, you can get a fairly good, by sampling kind of like any of them at random, you'll get a fairly good estimate.
You don't miss anything that's like hiding in some level.
Right, yeah. That, of course, okay, there can be exceptions. There can maybe be like some very special observable, I guess, maybe that if it's non-local or there's something special, but like for many observables, this is a good statement. Yeah?
So can you explain why it works well at high temperature? Because the way I understand, you have to sum over more states when you are at a higher temperature, so wouldn't that mean like—
Well, imagine, right now we're just imagining we're choosing those states at random though. Sorry, I should let you finish your question.
Yeah, so I was just concerned if that means more computational power.
So the idea right now though, remember that we're considering, again, like choosing these states at random. I think what you're thinking of is the case where like if you wanted to use your theoretical knowledge of the system to say like how many states contribute. But what I'm saying is basically if I choose like, I don't know, 100 states at random or something, and I average over all of them, like probably all of them are contributing fairly significantly to this sum. Whereas at low temperatures, there's only, I mean, if I'm in the limit of like zero temperature in the icing model, only two states are contributing. And what are my chances of choosing one of those two out of this exponential number? It's very small. Does it make sense?
Yeah,
so you're right though that I am in the high temperature limit, I'm not summing over all states that contribute significantly. Lots of them do. It's just that many of those states that contribute have the same probability. And if I average over several of them, I'm probably going to find like a fairly consistent estimate for this observable in many cases. That's the idea. Okay, so just to summarize why that fails, it's basically because at low temperature, there's only a few states that actually have high probability in the original sums that I was looking at. Yeah, question.
Sorry, I don't have much intuition about this, but
okay.
If we knew that like which states will like contribute at the low temperature, will this method be useful then?
I mean, if I knew, then if I already knew that, then I mean, we don't. In general, when we use these methods, we don't want to, I guess, make ourselves know a lot of these things in theory, right? Like a lot of the cases, we're trying to use these methods to discover the type of order that we have at low temperature, right? So yeah, of course, if we have more knowledge about the system, it's going to simplify the way that we can do things. Right now, I'm specifically studying the problem of choosing these states at random without telling it, without biasing the system to tell it, oh, I know that all up and all down are usually better states to choose. I don't want to tell it that in any way.
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea.
But if we knew, then you just put that in and it'll like compute.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I could for the Ising model in any dimension, and in any dimension, I could, in the limit of very low temperature, I could just do this sum, right? And if I'm calculating like my magnetization as my observable, it would just be one or minus one, right? Or the absolute value of it would be one. At high temperatures, I could also do this exactly because I reduce to just averaging over everything and I get zero for order parameter, for example. So. Yeah, definitely. In the limit of extremely low temperature, you could just do this sum exactly.
If you knew
some knowledge about the system. But again, we're like developing these methods or explaining them through the Ising model. But in a lot of cases, we don't know as much about our system as we do about the Ising model, right? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So. I chose initially in this estimator that I wrote down, I was choosing just from some flat distribution, but I can choose from any distribution, really. So let's say I have some distribution W that I'm able to sample from, then and this estimator QM, I'm going to have to account for the fact that I'm sampling from a different distribution when I do my sum. So I'm going to need to insert this additional weight factor in my sums to account for the fact that I'm biasing myself in my sampling towards this distribution. So the idea in our case, for example, is that the Boltzmann distribution is very hard to sample from because I don't know absolutely what all of these probabilities are. But maybe there are some other distributions that are still better than flat sampling that I do know how to sample from.
Why would have the minus one
power? Yeah, okay. I was waiting for that question. Okay, so the idea is that imagine you have, okay, the Boltzmann distribution, this is hard to draw. So let's just imagine the distribution I'm trying to sample from looks like this. But I don't know how to sample from this guy. Let's say I have some other distribution. I'm going to draw like some crazy thing that looks like, I don't know, like this. So this is my P mu, and this is my W mu. Well, if I sample from it in this region of space, it's going to choose these states more often than it should, right? So I want to inversely weight by that to account for the fact that I'm choosing them. I'm choosing them more often than I should. And reversely here, here I'm not going to choose them enough, so I want to weight by that in a way that's going to account for that properly. Remember that the W mu is just one you can sample from. It's not actually what you want to be sampling from. What you want to be sampling from is this one, which is your P. So we want to weight by this guy because it's what we actually want. But if I'm introducing some bias in the way I'm sampling, then I need to account for that bias by having the inverse of that there. Does it make sense? Yeah? Yeah.
So states that you're summing over, the M states chosen, which is not, like M is not to the end.
Right. Yeah. This capital M is like some, ideally some small number. Yeah.
Right. So those are chosen from the distribution W.
Mm-hmm.
And then you introduce the W inverse to account for that or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you figure out what like weight function to use?
Yeah. So that's what we're going to talk about, a specific case. The most ideal one, actually, I mean, ideally, I'd like to actually sample from the distribution I want, right? Then, I mean, first of all, the math would be easy. These would cancel. But also, you can imagine that I would actually like to sample the most probable states, right? And it turns out that we can do that in a way. So that's what I'm going to show you. So, but I mean, the idea in general is that maybe you have some distribution you can sample from.
So why would you want to, like, if you're choosing your weight distribution, like, so that it is the best fit, or like it'll give you higher probabilities when you want it to.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you want to like get rid of that bias if that's what you're trying to get? Like if you're trying to say, okay, well, W.
So this right now, I'm not saying at all what W's are better in this statement. This is just a general statement saying that if I give you, let's say I just only give you access to sampling from one distribution, you don't have access to any other type of sampling, then I'm saying that this is how you would need to, this is the best way that you could compute your estimator from that. I mean, then a separate question is like, how do I choose that W? I'm just telling you right now that this is what you should use to calculate this quantity given a specific distribution. Okay, so now I think I'm going to answer the question of like what we actually want to do this in the best way that we can. And for that, we want to use something called importance sampling. So the idea, as Elizabeth pointed out, is that, of course, we would really like to sample the more important states more often. So we really don't want this W to be just anything. We would like it to be something that kind of reflects how important our states are. And as much as I told you that we can't calculate this Boltzmann distribution exactly, or this is also exponentially hard to know all of these probabilities, it turns out I'm going to show you that we can actually sample from it. So right now, all I'm showing you, I'm not showing you how we do this. That's going to be the whole rest of the lecture. But it's just that if I'm able to sample such that the distribution I sample from is equal to P, So I'm not sure, but I'm worried that maybe a couple of minutes ago I maybe misspoke, because I was explaining to you that calculating this distribution is hard. I never meant to say that sampling from it is impossible or exponentially difficult. I'm going to show you how we can sample it. I was just trying to tell you that having access to these probabilities in absolute numbers, as in knowing that state mu has a probability of 0.1 or whatever it is, that's very hard to calculate because I need to know the partition function here. This is what I was meaning to say. So sorry if I said that incorrectly before. So anyway, the idea is that we want to be able to sample from this distribution. We don't actually have to know what each probability is to sample from it. And I'm going to show you how we can do that. Yeah. Yeah, please.
So we want our estimator to be this like equally weighted average. And why is that?
I wouldn't look at it from the form. I guess it's a bit nice that this is such a simple expression. It's just an average, but that's not really why we want to do this. It's more just that if you think in the limit of very low temperatures, it's more obvious, where at extremely low temperatures, like the limit of T goes to zero. In the icing model, for example, I basically get the case where the only terms that actually contribute to my sum are two different states, right? All up and all down out of some exponential number. So I would ideally like to be sampling those states when I'm calculating observables, right? So the idea is just that this is really more the goal. We want to be sampling from states that are actually important to describing our system.
Just when I look at the exact expression for the expectation value,
yeah,
it's this like weighted average.
Yeah.
And like, so for that expression, it seems to me that like to reproduce that, we actually want W inverse to be like constant. Like, I don't know.
If W inverse is constant, it's the first case I talked about. Then it's this one at the very top here, where I would still weight by that distribution. But again, like think about the case where only a few of your states are actually probable. My chance of choosing them is going to be very small. So that e to the minus beta e mu, it's going to be like some small number. And the q mu's that I actually calculate, they're going to be for some very improbable states in my system. So, you know, like there's nothing there saying that I'm going to actually be summing over the states that are better representations. So at high temperature, for example, I'm still going to sum over some like really random state like this. Now this, I mean, I can calculate the quantities, the observable quantities for this system, but the probability of finding this at low temperature is very small. So why would I want to include this very often in my sum? But if I use that first case, I have no reason to choose that state over this state. The idea is that like if maybe I can write this in a different way. Maybe I'll write this over here. So in general, I could say that the expectation value of a quantity, this is like the exact expression, right? This is equal to sum over mu, p mu, q mu, right? So this is going to be like, now let's consider at low temperatures in the icing model. then I mean, I'm gonna have, for example, let's consider my expectation of my magnetization, or actually it doesn't even matter what observable, let's leave it as Q. This, let's actually think about what this sum would be. Well, it's gonna be like 0.99 or something for the Q corresponding to the all up state, or sorry, I should say more like 4.9, because there's two that are probable. Right, it's gonna be this, plus still an exponential number of other terms, right? But they're all very small, like 0.001 times whatever. I'm just drawing something random, but like some random state here, right? So basically, if you choose things at random, your probability of selecting these terms is essentially zero as you go to the limit where n is very large. So you're basically going to look at a bunch of these terms, and you are going to weight them by some very small thing. But unless you have the contribution from the actually important states, you're not going to get a good estimate of those quantities.
But like, wouldn't we get an even better estimate if we, again, weight the end result also with the Boltzmann weight?
No, because that would be introducing some bias. Because now I've biased my sampling now. I'm sampling from this distribution. So if I put that in again, like this is an exact formula. I'm telling you that if I sample from some distribution W, then the estimate I want when it's the Boltzmann distribution, I need to inversely account for the bias that I'm introducing from my sampling. So if that's exactly the Boltzmann distribution, then I would be accounting for it twice if I left it in here. It just cancels in that expression. No, you're not convinced. I'm trying to think if I can think of a better... Yeah, okay, maybe we can talk about it later. But yeah, really I'm just like going from one mathematical expression to the other. So it's just not mathematically correct to have it in here. If I'm sampling from that distribution, I mean, still I'm accounting for the Boltzmann distribution. It's just I'm accounting for it in the way I'm sampling instead of the way I'm weighting my sum. But still these terms are being selected from the Boltzmann distribution. So like it's still kind of doing that weighted sum in a way, but it's just doing it through the sampling. Yeah, we can keep talking after or let me know if you have another question. Maybe I can try again to answer better. Okay, so let's now, this was kind of an aside. Just like, I didn't plan to say this, so I don't know if it was so clear. Just like, any other questions on here? No. Okay. So now I want to talk about a method for actually sampling from this distribution. That's Markov chain Monte Carlo. Okay, so what this really means is that, I mean, now this, I'm not really saying anything so unique in this statement yet, but the idea is that given some state somewhere somewhere in this sum, you know, that I want to sum over these m different states, so for one of them, I'm going to use that state somehow to generate the next state by introducing something called a transition probability. So I want to ask, though, what comes to mind when you guys hear about a Markov chain? Are there any features you think it should have? Just based on what you might have heard when you've heard that term before.
The idea that a Markov chain is like a sequence of steps so that every step has has something to do with, has only memory of the previous step and not anything before that.
Perfect, yeah, exactly. So I'll just write what you're saying in words. So, sorry, write it in words. You also said it in words. I mean, I'm going to write it on, I'm going to write it with a bit more of the notation that I want to use. But that was a great answer. So, if I imagine, you know, generating these states in some order, starting at mu 1 up to mu m, if I'm generating the next state mu m plus 1, it doesn't depend on mu 1 up to mu m minus 1. It only depends on the one I'm currently in and the one I'm trying to go to. And then in the examples we're going to consider, these transition probabilities are also going to be time independent. And the last condition is that I should have some normalization factor. So if I'm in some state mu and I consider all possible states nu that I can transition to, all those probabilities should sum to 1 because I have to transition somewhere. And this sum actually includes mu itself. So going to mu and staying at mu can be included in this sum. Okay, and so in the end, I get some set of states that are all generated by just looking at the one previously, and I call that a Markov chain.
So where does time come into the picture?
No, it doesn't. I'm just trying to make it clear that what I'm considering is like time-independent cases so that there shouldn't be any time dependence here.
What's that last condition?
Oh, it's just saying, I can write it bigger if you want. Sorry, I was just running out of space. I'll write it over here.
What does it mean?
It's just like a normalization of probabilities. So I'm saying that if you're in a state mu, transitioning to some nu, and I'm summing over all nu, all of those have to sum to 1. It's basically just the statement that a sum over all probabilities has to be 1. Okay, so if I want to eventually be sampling states from my target distribution W, which in our case is going to be this Boltzmann distribution, then it turns out I can do this if I satisfy two conditions when I use this Markov chain. So the first is ergodicity. So what comes to your mind when you hear ergodicity? Although you've heard this word before, maybe?
Time average is equal to the ensemble average.
Oh, okay. That's maybe, yeah. Okay, let's, can you think of it maybe without referring to the, without using the word time in your.
It like cycles through all the states?
Yeah, exactly. We want to have some chance of sampling all states. So, thank you. Okay, so what it formally means is that if I have any two states that I'm just saying are mu and nu, I have to have some way that I could possibly transition through them, through these transition probabilities. Doesn't mean I have to be able to do it directly. Maybe T mu to nu for those two states is actually zero, but there has to be some intermediate chain that allows me to do that. So even though I might not be able to go directly from mu to nu, I should be able to do it through some intermediate sequence in the algorithm that I design. Otherwise, I'm just restricting to some area of phase space that doesn't include all of my states. Oh, no, I want to bring this down. Sorry. So let me erase this, and then I'll see if you guys have questions about that. And I am going to check the anonymous thing. So if you want to ask an anonymous question, I'll look in just a second. Any questions? Anybody? Okay. So the second condition is called detailed balance. Okay, so this is basically saying I have to have some balance in the rates of transition into and out of my system. So for any state mu, okay, so the first term here is basically my rate of transitioning into a state. So I have to weight by all states it could be in before times the probability of transitioning into that state. And then transitioning out of it, I have my probability of being in that state. This could actually go outside of the sum. I've just written it like this because it's going to become easier in a second. And then I have to have my transition probability of going out of that state. So one way that we can do this is if I actually make these terms equal for each value of nu. And this is actually the detailed balance condition, which is what people usually impose in their simulations. Okay. Now remember, in our case, we'd like to sample from the Boltzmann distribution. So in this case, this tells us that I don't actually have a constraint on what each of these probabilities has to be. But I know that their ratio is going to need to be given by the exponential of minus beta times the difference in their energies. Okay, so what this really tells us is that according to detailed balance, we're free to choose those transition probabilities. So that's going to depend on the algorithm that we design. We just have to make sure that that ratio stays fixed so that we're really sampling from the right distribution. And if we don't do that, basically we're just not, we're not studying the right system. We'd be studying a system with a different Hamiltonian or something like that if we don't satisfy that condition. Any questions?
How do we determine you what the first sample?
Yeah, we're going to talk about it, but I'll give you the short answer. In most cases, we're just going to choose it randomly. So what it means is that the first several states that you generate are not actually a good representation of your state space, because you're just going to choose the first one randomly. But you can actually prove that you'll converge to the right distribution.
The problem is we have this detailed balance. Then the distribution doesn't change with time. If the initial distribution is a random distribution, how can we get to the target distribution?
Because I think this is assuming that, I think I wrote something wrong. I think this should actually say, no, this is right, sorry. I thought this was supposed to be a P. I think it's basically because there's a difference between the distribution W and the distribution P. So the distribution W is the one that you're sampling from. I'm just trying to think of how you can see it from this expression. I think the idea is that basically, in the beginning you're still sampling from this. It's just that you're sampling from regions of W that actually have low probability. So you're not actually changing those probabilities ever. This is always true. I think the answer is just that initially you're going to choose some state at random so that at low temperature it probably has a very low probability. And we want to move to a region of state space with high probability. So if I do the sums over those, I'm going to be probably summing if I do this sum directly and I really start at 1 from my first state, I'm going to be summing over some very low probable states, which isn't very good. So I don't want to start right away. I want to do some sampling before I actually start taking these sums. But you will get to a point where you're able to actually get to a practically there can be difficulties with this, but in theory you will converge to a region of higher probability. Practically, that can take a very long time, and that's an issue that people often run into with their algorithms, is that they're not sampling the right area of state space when they start randomly. But you will eventually get there.
The detailed balance is, because it's just telling you about the rate of transition into and out of a particular state.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't put any constraints on that you have to stay in any particular area of space, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so the idea is that the transitions are actually going to be favoring transitions into more probable states. That's how we're going to design this. Yeah, so you're going to be pushed to more favorable states by those transition probabilities. Okay, so let's see an example. There's many ways we can do this, but in general, people often use this notation when they describe their algorithms. So I'm going to say that my algorithm actually is going to have two parts to it. First, I have to propose a move or select a move. This is called my selection probability. So my algorithm will do that, and then I'm going to choose if I should accept it. So we'll see an example, but this is my So I have to have some algorithm that kind of suggests moves for me. So this first one, this G, is going to be the probability that I'll propose a move new when I'm in a state new. And then this one is my acceptance probability. So the idea is basically that I don't have to be so smart if I don't want to in the way that I design my selection probabilities, because I can make sure that I satisfy detailed balance in how I accept things. And that's very easy to do. But it won't necessarily be a very good algorithm, but it will still satisfy detailed balance. So basically, I have to make sure I have this. So in general, I'm only fixed again by a ratio. So I'm free to choose this in many different ways. But in many cases, I really want those acceptances to be close to one if I can, at least when, and since I'm only fixing the ratio, I should be able to have one of them close to one. Because otherwise, I'm just going to keep staying at that same state mu and keep sampling the same state, which in many cases is not a good thing. So this is, in general, when we use the Metropolis algorithm, this actually is gonna, it's just a very simple expression that means that one of those acceptances is always gonna be one in one direction. So this is just kind of a smart way to do that so that I move through state space as efficiently as possible. So it's going to be one for either going mu to nu or going nu to mu. And then the other one I have to fix by detailed balance.
Sorry.
Yeah.
So this algorithm violates the detailed balance, right?
No, it actually doesn't. No, you can prove that it satisfies detailed balance. Because, because it has this, yeah. So when you... If you're going mu to nu, it'll be one of these, and then when you go in the opposite direction, it'll be the other one, and you should satisfy it. Yeah?
What goes wrong if we just accept every state that we propose?
Well, I mean, if you had a very good algorithm, it's okay. It's just that your algorithm is composed of a selection and an acceptance. If you had, like, perfect selection so that you're always generating things that satisfy detailed balance, that's just very difficult to do. So this is basically... allowing us to have an algorithm that doesn't really know always how to do this, how to sample from the distribution, but then we can fix it by kind of having this acceptance. There are some algorithms where the acceptance is one. Those are very good algorithms. So the one I'm going to talk about to you about today is kind of the most naive algorithm, and it doesn't have that, but there are some very smart algorithms that do for some systems. It depends. So for the Ising model, and the XY model, such smart algorithms exist where your acceptance can be one. But for other models, it's maybe not known whether you can have that. Okay, so now we're kind of at the point where we can start. So this is now, I mean, I still haven't really told you an explicit form for G yet. So I haven't actually really given you ideas up to a point where you'd be able to go and write code that actually does this for a system. So let's now start talking about a specific model. So since it somewhat connects to some things we covered in the course, let's talk about the XY model. So this is how I can write my XY model. It's spins with two components. But they can only rotate. Their magnitude has to be fixed at one. So the way that we're actually going to kind of study it more is in terms of their angles. So each one has some angle theta, and we can study how they rotate. And just as for the Ising model, I can study this on a lattice of any dimensions. In the simulation I'm going to show you, it's in 2D, just because it's easiest to visualize and already gives interesting features. But of course, you can study this in higher dimensions as well. So I'm drawing this in D equals two, but in general I can have spins, or we often call them rotors. They're just rotating on the sides of a D-dimensional lattice. So my goal today is really to show you how to do simulations of the XY model, but I just want to remind you of something that Chong said in lecture 11, which is that because of the universality that we see when we study some of these Ginzburg-Landau theories, phase transitions in this XY model can have some overlap with phenomena that we might see in a BCS superconductor. Okay, so that's just kind of to motivate, I guess, why it's relevant to look at this specific model, why I chose that one. Often when I give a lecture like this, I would start with the Ising model, but since we only have one lecture, the simulations also look a lot more interesting for the XY model, and in the last few minutes, I do want to show you an actual simulation. And I can also, if you guys are interested, I can post an optional tutorial on this stuff, which of course is not for the interview, but it's one that I've used in the past when I'm teaching XY model. Of course, we don't have any tutorials left, but just if anyone's interested, I'll post that so you can kind of see how this algorithm I'm about to talk about will actually work and what you can do with it. Okay. Yeah.
When you said for metropolis algorithm, mm-hmm. very good algorithms can get acceptance rate one. And whenever I work with that, I try to get acceptance rate around one hop. Is an acceptance rate one a bad thing? Like you're stuck in one region of the phase space.
Oh no, because so maybe you're thinking of something else. Because no, it's actually kind of the opposite of what you said. So if I take, 0.5 is maybe still okay. But the reason one is good is because this is talking about accepting a move out of mu, going mu to nu. If I have this acceptance rate.
You have one region of phase space where your walkers want to be.
Yeah.
And you're moving in very small steps, you're going to be stuck there. And you're going to accept all the steps, you're never going to move away. Usually when I get too large of an acceptance rate, I would increase my steps so that I move.
Oh, you're saying that.
Everything.
Once you find a good region of phase space that maybe you want to stay there. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That, like, for example, at low temperature, basically we are going to find that at low temperature, we basically are staying in one state for a lot of these algorithms. In the Ising model, for example, we would just be in the spin up or the spin.
You can basically be stuck in local minimum and not find the real.
I think this is a different issue than the acceptance rates, though. So what you're referring to is actually more of like an ergodicity issue. So we've said that one condition on here, another condition separate from detailed balance, is that we want to be able to get to different regions if we're really doing the sampling properly. In practice, the probability of getting between different regions is often very small. There's many states that are very unlikely. But if we have our algorithm treat them with absolutely zero probability, that's not okay. So that's the statement of ergodicity. And a lot of algorithms that you have will be ergodic in principle, but in practice they're not. So there could be, as you said, two different local minima, and one of them is actually a better solution than the other. But in practice, even though there's some non-zero probability to transition between them, the actual expected time I would need to run a simulation to do that could be extremely long, and I would never be able to actually reach that. So I think that's maybe more what you're talking about, that you So yeah, in some cases it's good to be in some region of space, phase space, but you would kind of need to know ahead of time what that region is. So we don't necessarily want to say that we are restricting to that area, right? We want to have some balance between exploring and also sampling the highly probable state. So we only want to do this, like we're only going to accept this transition if it's to a highly probable state. So that is accounted for in these W's here. So what you're saying is like, oh, maybe my state space, the part of state space that I'm already in is really good. So I want to stay there. But you will stay there because that's what you're ensuring.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
Imagine like a very simple system. You have curved surface and like literal walkers moving around.
Okay.
And now, if you're moving in very small steps and you find a local loop, you're going to stay there. You're never going to go out because your walker likes to be there.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Then if you increase your step,
yeah,
you're going to explore a larger surface and maybe you'll find something deeper. Like
yeah.
Some
right. Mm-hmm.
And then, if you look at your acceptance rate, if you keep it at one, it's not going to be a good thing.
Okay.
Where I usually did, I would change my variables in a simulation so that my acceptance rate is always around, like, wants to be at 1/2. Because then you go, you explore bigger part of the phase space and usually you do that.
Okay. So again, just to emphasize though, I think that what you're describing is different than this. So I think the best analogy, because what you're describing is not quite the same setup as here, but I think, okay, let me think for a sec. I think the best way I can say that is that when you talk about taking a step and you're talking about how big your step size is, remember that you're only talking about moves in one direction. Like we want to think of a move in one direction plus a move going back. And so this constraint is on the ratio. So I'm just saying that one of those moves should be likely. So in your case, I think it's probably the one going back towards the minimum would be the likely one. And then the one going out would not be likely. But again, if you set these things closer to 0.5, I mean, you can do it. It just means one of the directions is not going to be likely. But what it's really going to mean is that you get stuck for longer. Rather than exploring. You're not exploring, it means that you're rejecting moves. So you're always just going to keep staying at mu. So your Markov chain is going to be mu, 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 if you never accept moves. So I just think it's, maybe we can talk after, because I think like, I think you're making a really good point, but I think maybe like the notation and the language to go to the problem you're describing is maybe not so similar to this language. So maybe we would need to change some of these formulas to really be describing what you're describing. But yeah, let's talk after about that. But yeah, it's an interesting point. Okay, so what I'm going to talk to you is the very simplest algorithm that we can do, which is a single spin update algorithm. So the simplest algorithm we can have really is that we'll be starting in some state and we'll just consider very similar states that only differ by a single rotation. So imagine this is like some region of my lattice. I've only drawn 4 spins. There could obviously be much more. But let's say I choose this spin. then the move I'm going to propose is that I'm going to rotate this by some theta that I choose at random. Yeah.
Is the choice of the site part of the move, or is it...
That's another part of the algorithm. Although we would just do it at random in most cases. We would just choose the site randomly. So I can write that in. This is the algorithm we're going to look at, is just choosing that site randomly.
Okay. So yeah. So for the angle, we already fixed the site we're going to rotate, and then we do a Markov chain with those.
Oh no. Sorry. For every, okay, so I would start with some full configuration. Then I would choose one site, I would propose a rotation. That would give me potentially my next state. Then I do that all over again. I choose another site at random, could be the same, could be different. So in this case, the move I'm proposing, I mean, it depends on what value of delta theta I choose at random, but it could look something like that. So in this case, my selection probabilities. So basically, I'm only going to select moves that differ by a single spin rotation for one move. Of course, I can still transition between states with more than one move. But one single move is only going to take me between states that are different at one location. And so I think now from here, we can really see how we are moving towards states that have a higher probability. Basically, at low temperatures, we know that we kind of prefer the low energy states. So the idea is that we're always going to accept moves to low energy states, and we're going to reject them otherwise. But definitely, this is going to get you stuck in local minima, which is maybe one thing you were bringing up. This algorithm in particular will. There's better algorithms that won't get you stuck in local minima so badly. And I should say too, while I'm erasing the board, I'll just kind of say this, that for icing model, you could use basically the same algorithm. It's just that you wouldn't be able to rotate by some angle. You would just choose a spin and propose flipping it. And then you could really use the same idea. So although I've written it for x, y, this algorithm is actually fairly easy to change so that it's more general to many different models. Okay, so before I'm just want to write one more thing before I kind of show you just what happens when you do this simulation, which is just to summarize for you the steps. So the first state that I'm going to choose is just going to be chosen at random. Now, I just don't have so much time to talk about all the subtleties of this. In practice, you don't really want to include these when you do your averages because they're not very indicative of the region of state space you actually want. So you would, in practice, run this algorithm a little while before you actually start recording your samples. If you're interested in that, maybe let's talk about that later, just so we can get through the rest. I'm just running out of time. I don't want to keep you guys long. That is a really interesting point that I think some of you are wondering about, but please feel free to talk to me about it after. I'm like very happy to talk about it. So remember that I have n particles here. So to do one update, I'm just going to choose one site of my lattice at random. Then I'm going to choose some random amount to rotate by. Where, in this case, I'm just going to choose this from a uniform distribution. You could play with other distributions, too. So then once I've chosen a site and proposed some amount that I'll rotate that rotor by, I can calculate the energy difference associated with that. And now I want to choose whether I'm going to accept or reject that move. Okay, so to do that numerically, what I actually do is I use a random number. So the way that I actually accept something with a probability is usually done by choosing a random number from a random distribution and then making my decision whether this random number is depending on what the value is compared to the probability that I want. So depending on the value of that number, if my other energy change is negative, I don't even need that random number. But if the energy change is positive, I'm going to check whether that random number is less than this exponential. If that's the case, I'm going to move. And otherwise, I will reject the move. And in that case, it means I'm just not going to change where I am. So my next state in my chain is just going to be the same as the one I was already in. So I forgot to write down the actual reference for these papers, but there are better algorithms out there that are kind of broadly referred to as cluster algorithms that update more than one spin at a time so that you don't get stuck as often in local minima. And so some that you could look up, for example, are ones by Wolf or Swenson Wang. Those are some better algorithms that are going to have better performance than this one. But this is the most simple one we could write down. Do you guys have questions? Okay, I'm going to ask for the screen to come down for just a minute. That works. Usually they hear. I can try to do it from here otherwise.
Okay.
And I'll just quickly show you guys this and then I will let you go, don't worry. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Ask a question, sorry.
The kind of intuitive picture of the algorithm would be that you're sort of lowering the energy of everything and forcing it to a minimum.
At low temperatures, that's the case, yeah. At higher temperatures, this probability can still be quite high. So we definitely still accept moves that don't lower the energy.
Yeah. You can have, even if you have several local minima, you allow for some sort of channeling.
Yeah.
Not much.
Yeah. At low temperature, that's not the case. At low temperature, we'll for sure get stuck because this goes to zero in the limit of very low temperature. It goes to zero if my energy change is positive.
What are some ways of either proving you're in the global minimum or guaranteeing it's kind of at least goodish enough? Because I remember I did this. Something very similar for a Vanderbilt gas in my freshman year, and it was a little bit of a mess because I could never quite get it.
I think it's very difficult, actually, in general, to know your solution because, again, an icing model, yeah, I can just check. I can check and say, like, oh, did I reach the all up or all down state? Because I know that that's my ground state. But if you think of this from a perspective that you, oh, shoot. It's updating, sorry. Just one second. Let me write this so I'm not multitasking. In general, we maybe need to have some physical insight to know if we're in the right place. Sometimes you can look at the observables you get out as a function of temperature, for example, and you'll just kind of notice that they start behaving weird at some point, which probably means you're getting stuck, depending on how they're behaving. Like, you'll have some really nice smooth curve, and then all of a sudden it's a mess. It probably means, like, there's some issue with your sampling when you're reaching that point. So there can be some indicators, but we don't always know exactly what we expect to find, obviously, right? So I think there's lots of subtleties associated with what you're asking.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if that answers.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Okay, so this is code that I'm not going to go through because I'll share it with you guys if you're interested, but this just goes through this simulation, and you can record different observables. But what I'm going to do is just show you the samples that it's choosing using this algorithm. So I'm starting on a very small lattice, just 5 by 5. You can see at the top, initially the temperature is 5. So as we expect at high temperatures, things are very random. It doesn't really seem like we're preferring anything in phase space over some other state. But then it should step down in temperature. Now it's at 3, so it's gone from 5 to 3. In this case, I think the phase transition, which of course corresponds to an infinite system, is around 2.269, I think. So this is kind of near the transition, but still it looks quite random, especially on this finite system. Now we go down to 1. You can start to see that the fluctuations are becoming smaller, but it still does have some randomness there. And then it'll eventually step down one more time. Yeah.
So the transition is at 0.8 or 9. Like, I think you're mentioning the
icing. Oh, sorry, I'm saying icing. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. The transition is lower. Yeah, my bad. Thank you. Yeah. In any case, in a finite system, you won't necessarily see some sharp change in behavior. But yeah, you're right. Thank you. I said the wrong temperature. Yeah, and now you can see that at very low temperature, it's basically aligned. So last thing I want to show you is something cool you can see in here, which is just that you can actually see the formation of vortices happening. So I'll show you a much bigger system, and I'll give you the code if you want to play with this a little bit, but you can see that you start getting some regions of space where vortices form. So where's the hockey stick? So here, for example, you see a vortex forming. They usually occur in pairs. So there, I think there's an anti-vortex over here. And it turns out for the XY model in 2D, these vortices are really important for describing your phase transitions, which we're not talking about in a lot of detail, but it's a very interesting area. I'll share this code and some exercises with you guys in case you want to try this. if you're interested, maybe after interviews or just anytime you're interested. But I'll maybe stop here. If people have questions, feel free to stay, and I'll let you guys go for lunch. So, okay, good.